More than a million articles are published each year. Humans can't keep up with that. The computers, the technology can. So how do you bring those things together to make a really powerful solution to augment the healthcare provider's capability to do better by you, to improve your health, to improve your wellness?
Welcome to the Business of AI in Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Bob Kaiser. Our mission is to discuss practical insights and share knowledge on how to navigate the transformative technology of AI. It's important to understand how AI can be used safely and ethically while revolutionizing patient care, streamlining operations, and enhancing medical research. Today, we visit Richard Kidziora from the Jersey Shore. Richard, better known as RJ, is the co-founder of Astenda Solutions. They specialize in custom software development, AI machine learning, and data analytics for life sciences and med tech companies. Besides being a digital health AI expert and an aspiring author, RJ's a triathlete with a life goal of 100 plus years of good quality life. Welcome to the Business of AI and Healthcare podcast, RJ.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks for having me. And yes, the 100 plus years with a good quality of life. And that second part is the true benefit of living to 100 plus. I don't want to be sitting around at home. I want to be out there racing.
We have that in common. I'm not quite the triathlete that you are, but I seem to put left foot, right foot out there on the pavement and get a lot of running in. And I'm the same. I really fully expect there's no reason, unless there's some type of tragic accident, that we can't live a really good quality of life. So we have a lot to talk about today. Let's start off with your company. I'm always curious about the name of the company. And this has been going on. You've got 20 years of history. That's to be celebrated, number one. But tell us the name, Astenda Solutions.
Yeah, thank you. It is, we're 23 years young now. That was one of the biggest challenges, coming up with the name of the company. So it was Drew Lewis, my fellow co-founder, and I sat around and Superior Consulting, Great Consulting, all the sort of typical things that came to mind. We're just really trying to work through that and didn't like the idea of the acronyms or dropping letters out of a name or something like that. So Astenda is Portuguese for extend. So the idea is we can help extend the enterprise. As we are a consulting organization, we work with a number of large corporations, smaller organizations, startups, helping them develop products, technologies that they take out into the world or use internally to improve patient care and outcomes.
Deep, rich history there, 23 years. Start to reflect back just a little bit. You and I have got a common denominator in some respects from the technology perspective. As a young engineer, one of the first little things I got to play with was a microprocessor. And it was like the 6502 processor. And what can you do with this? And how do you hook a keyboard to it and a monitor and things like that? You've got a similar background. Share a little bit about how you stumbled into or fell into this world of technology.
I was fortunate in middle school, my parents were able to buy a personal computer, an IBM PC Junior at the time. And that's what got me started. I definitely played my fair share of games because we got an Atari game system right about the same time frame. So it definitely played lots of Space Invaders and other games. But I was always fascinated what I could do with the computer. So I was at that early age developing little games and graphic simulations and things like that that you could do on those computers. And even through high school, this just popped into my head as you were describing your background. I was very fortunate from high school perspective, too, that we had one of the science teachers really went above and beyond what you would normally expect and worked with companies like DEC, if you remember them from years ago, and bringing those computers and technology into the classroom. So I actually learned how to program in binary and had to flip digits on a computer and turn a dial to input it into the registry. And that was just fascinating. Today, as you learn computer science and technology, that's all abstracted, many layers away from what you have to actually deal with. But yeah, I was fortunate. Incredible teachers, incredible opportunities growing up. And so I did go to university for computer science. And interestingly, as we sit today now, and AI is such a big topic of conversation, in the early 90s, my goal was to get a PhD in artificial intelligence. And many people scoff at that and go, it wasn't around back then. Yes, it was. It's not what it is today, but it has been around for quite a while. And even beyond that, interestingly, I got a job offer though. And it was like more debt, more school, or go out into the world and start earning a living. So I did go out into the world and start earning a living. But I've always kept my hand in the AI technologies of the day.
So for you, AI isn't this brand new thing called ChatGPT, is it?
No, it is not. The passion, the interest started early days just reading Isaac Asimov and other science fiction authors of what they thought AI would be today. It's not quite what those authors, amazing as they were not quite there yet and what they imagined, but it is truly incredible what the technology can do today. There is through the 90s, the 2000s, you think more of machine learning types of technologies to AI intelligent systems that were very specific to a use case. And we got into involved in some expert systems around medication reminders and things like that. And those expert systems 25, 30 years ago were really how do you codify and simplifying it in a lot of if statements, the expertise of a human. It just doesn't scale, and trying to maintain that over time just proved not to be an effective strategy. And now
So
here we are today.
it's safe to say that you were a nerd as a young man. Is that true?
That is a fair assessment, yes.
Okay. I remember when I got out of engineering school, I got a job like you. I wanted to go on and make a living. And I got a job working for a Fortune 500 company. And I was so disappointed when I showed up. They had me sit down and review documents. Piping and instrument documents. And I thought, oh my God, I went to engineering school and I learned all this to do that. And I stumbled into another group within this big company, this little Skunk Works. And I walked in the door. This place was next to a barbecue and a dry cleaner. And I walked in there and the guy said, can you do a 32-bit math? I need multiply, add, subtract, divide, 32-bit for a 6800 microprocessor. And I said, sure. I had no idea how to do it. But that gave me a chance to start to tinker in this microprocessor world. Today, if I wanted to write a 32-bit in assembler language math package, I would simply go to ChatGPT and ask it to do that for me. In your line of business, are you guys using AI to help do code development in a big way?
What's interesting about that is you can't really avoid it today. As the developers out there in the industry, not just here, as part of the packages that you develop with and use, that code suggestions, so next best word kind of thing, you see it in when you use Gmail or whatever account, email account, where it's suggesting next words on your smartphones. That suggestion of next word is AI related technology to be able to do that. So it's people talk about are they using AI every day? More people are using it than they realize. Specific to computer programming, it's not quite there yet. It is fascinating what it can do. And as you prompt it, it's getting better and better. It's a very fast moving technology. There's a lot of fear in general in technology, in marketing, in healthcare, around the idea is AI going to replace us? And I don't think so. Right? It's going to increase our efficiency. It's going to make us better at what we're doing, but you still need to know and understand what to ask it to do. And that was one of those things that I learned really early on in my career. Technology is important. Technology is powerful, but it is about the people, the processes, that empathy and understanding what someone actually needs. As software developers, you're developing for somebody else. You're not developing for yourself. And that makes a huge difference in using these technologies. So I have a goal. When you play with these technologies, what are you trying to accomplish? And we have an internal time tracking system that is well overdue for being updated. And I've looked at the time tracking packages that are available on the internet and the services, and they're just cost prohibitive. It's for what they do. I'm like amazed at how much they charge per person. So I'm like, I want to use the ChatGPTs of the world to just create this system for me. And I'm not going to code a line. Like, it's just going to handle it. And it's not quite there yet. It is incredible what it does and what it's capable of. But just as an instance, one of the tools I was using the other day, and it was like, add a day checker. And it didn't, and it's okay, added the day checker, and the day checker wasn't there. I'm like, can you add the day checker? And it just kept coming back to me. I already did that for you. I'm like, no, you didn't. I started arguing with it, and I didn't win that argument. So started all over again. The second time around, it worked better. So we're not quite there yet, but it is definitely improving day by day, which is incredible.
So in the development process, then you actually see AI actually helps enhance that overall development process, maybe helping out with the requirements analysis, which is important, maybe some of the brainstorming. Does it fit into those areas? That's a big component of creating a solution, right?
Yes, I think it actually helps, and I use that in my day-to-day experience. So, for example, I had to do some interviews of various experts in the area of smell testing. We're getting into a project here looking at smell testing, olfactory, and the loss of smell. It's one of those things that didn't get a lot of attention until COVID happened. Now there's a lot more research dollars and attention being paid to the loss of smell and the impact of that. And so I've never talked to a PhD research expert in the loss of smell, but I've done dozens, if not hundreds, of user interviews over the years. So I could sit down and figure this out, but I went into ChatGPT and was like, here's my situation. Here's my background, what I wanted to accomplish, who I was talking to. Here's a link to their CV. And it generated 10 questions to ask to start that conversation. And what's fascinating is give me 10 more questions. Give me 10 more questions. Give me 10 more questions ad infinitum. And it does. And then I didn't generate 1,000 questions by any means, but it's okay. What are these top 10 questions that I really want to use? And yes, I could have done that. But instead of taking an hour or 2 hours to go through this process and review all this information, in mere minutes, I was able to accomplish the same thing. And today, you do have to, in the early days of these generative AI systems, you have to apply your own expertise to it, make sure that it's not hallucinating or making something up. It does tend to sound very authoritative. Oh, okay. But you do have to be aware of that. And I think of it as an 80% solution. It's getting me 80% of the way there, but much faster. And then I can apply that last 20%.
We start to look at the complexity of these AI solutions, and sometimes I get the appearance of people just trying to whitewash, if you will, AI. They're going to put the word AI on their label. They're going to really just slap some terminology around AI, make people feel like this is something magic. You've come up with the term augmented intelligence. Tell me why that suits your needs better.
I can't claim to be the first person to use that terminology, but I think of it as augmented because how do you use the technology to improve your capabilities, the team's capability, the company capabilities? And that's where that augmentation comes in. It's not going to replace me anytime soon. It's going to augment and make me better, more efficient than my example of the expert interview. It's, yes, I absolutely could have sat down and done that. Done it for decades now, which is always interesting to say that I can have been doing anything for decades. But I was able to do it much faster, which was a beautiful thing, and then get on to the next project, the next thing that I was trying to accomplish. And so that's where it's augmented intelligence. And for me in my daily life, where we work in the area of digital health, it's like your doctor. How often have you gone to your doctor and they're typing in the computer to try and capture all sorts of information, not maybe talking to you as much as you want as a patient, or they as the doctor want to talk to you? Doctors, healthcare professionals get into the profession to help people. They didn't get into the profession to sit there and type on a keyboard. So one of the huge new use cases for this AI is the ambient listening technology. So it can just listen in the room to that conversation and take notes and apply that. But it doesn't just, it's not verbatim, which is one of the powers of the technology. It can translate what the patient's saying into that clinical speak. So an example I've seen bandied around is the idea the patient says, "Yeah, my legs are restless and I can't fall asleep at night, so I take two shots of whiskey." Okay, not the best medical thing to do. And that's the AI then transcribes that is like not in those languages. It's like patients taking medical alcohol for his purposes, kind of thing. So it makes that translation into more clinical speak, which is interesting from that perspective. It's adding value, augmenting that patient encounter. Now, fast forward to where this technology, I'm dying to see this in various projects, is one, the AI can summarize and understand what's going on in that patient's experience and has access to all those notes, but then also has access to all the knowledge that the medical field creates every day. You and I cannot keep up with that level of information. I saw some stats recently that a hospital, large healthcare system hospital, each year generates 50 petabytes of information, which is 51 million gigabytes. Just vast amounts of data and information. More than a million articles are published each year. You and I can't keep up with this. Humans can't keep up with that. The computers, the technology can. So how do you bring those things together to make a really powerful solution to augment the healthcare provider's capability to do better by you, to improve your health, to improve your wellness, and let them not sit there and type at a keyboard, let them actually talk to you and interface with you as an individual, as a human?
Let's go down a path of understanding. Astenda Solutions, I like people to understand if they came to you and said, "Look, I've got a problem I'm trying to solve. I think AI might be an element of this. I've got a lot of data. I've got a complex environment. Boy, I just don't know where to start." I would think they could lean into Astenda and that you guys could start that process overall. When you have a complex environment like that, help our audience understand how you would start assessing the practicality of using AI. Guide us through those first steps that you might take a client through to really make them feel comfortable that you've got the right type of tools and insights to deliver on this.
You said in that question, you said the magic word, which was data. And so many of these AI projects start with data. And so as we get involved in these projects, it's one assessing, okay, what are your goals? What are you trying to accomplish? And is generative AI the right solution? It might not be. So we definitely don't go into it with blinders and say, okay, client said Gen AI, so this is what we're going to use. We do a full assessment of what your goals are, what you're trying to accomplish, what your level of technical expertise is as an institution, particularly when it comes to data, because that's where everything starts from. So do you have proper control of your data, the data governance strategies in place, such that we can know where this information is and make effective use of it? It is still a challenge in the healthcare industry in general, managing data. It's the last industry to embrace data. So healthcare has definitely embraced technology. Just look at MRIs and ultrasounds and all these gee whiz bang devices to get at additional information about the human condition. It's amazing. But we're still early in the stages of embracing data. That's where every project starts today, is assessing and understanding the data and what you want to accomplish from a project perspective. Software projects in general don't have a high rate of success. But I always look at that stat with a smirk at it. It's how are you judging success from that perspective? If you think back to the 80s and 90s, it was very much a waterfall methodology. Define everything up front and figure out everything I want to do, and then go for 3 years and try and implement that. But that's not reality. So in the early 2000s, we came up with the idea of agile software development, not me individually, the industry came up with this idea of agile development such that you change and adapt and morph over time to better understand what you want to do. Our projects are typically on the R&D side. And so I think of it when we get into these, we take a small A agile approach. We don't follow specifically Scrum or Kanban or one of these technologies, and we don't have to get into the specifics of those, but it's adapting and understanding what the customer is looking to do. And as you are in those early stages, it's a process of discovery. Okay, I heard Gen AI. What can I really do with Gen AI? What are the risks of a Gen AI approach to this? And we change and adapt as we go through the processes.
I think some of these real-world cases that are starting to be exposed are pretty remarkable. One of those I know that you've been involved with, RJ, over a long 20-plus years has to do with diabetes and retinopathy, looking at the retina to determine early stages of diabetes. Tell us a little bit about that. It goes back a long ways, and technology changed over the period of time. You started that with Walter Reed Army Medical Center 20 years ago.
It's over 20 years now. The program came out of the Joslin Diabetes Center. We had a part of a congressional grant, the development of a diabetes disease management solution, specifically looking at diabetic retinopathy and bringing in other variables into the picture, not just the actual image of the eye, but your labs, your blood glucose levels, to create a comprehensive picture of that patient. And we got to work with your reference, Walter Reed Army Medical Center, the Boston VA, the Indian Health Services out of Phoenix. The Indian Health Services, if people aren't familiar, is responsible for the health and care of the American Indian, Alaska Native population here in the US. So have a great mission there. And fortunately, we've been part of that. So it's deployed now at over 100 sites throughout the US. And we are looking for incidences of diabetic retinopathy. It's the leading cause of preventable blindness. If we find it, it's treatable. And what's interesting about diabetic retinopathy and AI specifically is some of the earliest machine learning AI algorithms were FDA approved, I think back in like 2016, 2017. But this is one of those challenges of AI. Those original systems don't work on newer camera technology. So now what we deploy is ultra-wide camera technology. So you went from a very narrow field of view where you're only seeing a small part of the retina or the back of the eye to now a lot more of that area. And it's ultra-wide, I think it's 200-degree field of view. So you're seeing a lot more information. So you can find a lot more incidence of disease than you could before because you're just seeing more. A very easy concept to understand. But those AI systems, the original ones, they were trained on those older, smaller images. And so those systems are still in place in various different, they haven't gone away. Those different cameras are still very much viable and used in the world. Our program happens to use the ultra-wide camera technology. So we have been involved in various projects to train new AI systems in this new image. And so as technology progresses 2, 3 years down from the road, we're probably going to have to reassess those AI algorithms. That's a key factor when you're using these machine learning technologies to make sure as the technology changes, you're still getting the same outcomes and results. So it's not create the technology and put it out there and it's going to work forever. You need to monitor and maintain that over time to make sure that it does continue to work.
So that gets back to the topic of data. If you start to collect these images, having some type of metadata on these images, the different demographics of that data, the HIPAA aspect of that data, being able to share that data and train on it and keep it fresh, boy, that sounds like just a huge, unsurmounting problem, a difficult problem to solve. How do you begin to even figure out managing all of that in a safe, ethical way?
That's what Ascend has been doing for over the years and building up our capabilities and knowledge and methodologies for doing that. Because, yes, absolutely, you need to protect those images. You can't just take an image that was used in a clinical encounter and use it for research. You need to be able to anonymize that data. And images can have embedded information in them. So we've developed algorithms, software programs to extract that data such that they are truly anonymized. Sometimes it's even just imprinted on the actual image, not in metadata. So then you have to go and scrub the image and make sure that you're not removing any actually clinically valid information. Yes, lots of challenges over the years, and we continue to do those and meet new standards as they're developed to make sure that we are protecting the data.
I've heard recently there are some collaborative platforms that you can take your algorithm and secure it, encrypt it, submit it to this collaborative platform, also get data and have it submitted into this collaborative secure platform. The data doesn't have to be identified, de-identified, and the algorithms can work and test on that to see if the model's being trained appropriately, and it has a trusted environment like that. That seems like a really positive direction as far as managing big programs where you have a lot of data that you need to get from different sources. Have you heard of things like that yet?
There are a lot of technologies out there that do those types of things. And you do, depending on your vendor relationships, you do have to make sure that if you're sending that identified data there, that they are properly controlling that, have the right security protocols in mind. You just don't want to send it off there. That's with the Gen AIs and ChatGPTs. That's one of the things that I hear about. Oh, it's not HIPAA compliant. I can't use it to ask it questions about my patient. But one, those organizations will sign business associate agreements now with organizations, which is the legal document that says, yes, we can share information back and forth and it's controlled. But also think about if you're a clinician and you're dealing with a particularly challenging patient, you don't have to tell ChatGPT, hey, it's Bob Kaiser, it's RJ Kedziora. You don't need to identify the individual to be able to get meaningful information out of them. But that is when we talk about how we use Gen AI to be more efficient every day, it's that generating data, like completely made up data. It's immensely powerful for just doing that. In early stages, I don't even need to take real patient data and go through the anonymization process. It's generate me a data set of 25 patients that have diabetes of varying ages, and it'll generate that data. And then graph it. So if you look at patients with diabetes and these continuous glucose monitors, they can generate data as much as one reading a minute. And so when you're looking at that information from a like tabular format, like in an Excel spreadsheet, it's really hard to see what's going on. But presented in a graph or chart, and it just pops out, it's much more easy to understand. And that's the beautiful part of ChatGPT. It's, hey, generate me this data set for a patient with type 1 diabetes and eats these three meals during the day and chart it so I can see it. And then it's, oh, okay, can you make them, instead of eating spaghetti for lunch yesterday, that they have a steak? How does that impact their blood glucose? And it'll generate those different data sets for it. We referenced triathlon early in our conversation, and I did the same thing with ChatGPT. It was like, generate me this data where the patient eats and then goes and exercises afterwards. And you can see the difference in the data, which is powerful to be able to. Early use cases. You definitely want to test new algorithms and ideas with actual data to make sure the AI isn't introducing some artifact. But to get you started, powerful methodology.
That's a good segue. I'm going to change topics here just a little bit off of the intensity of AI and data and all of that. Aspiring author, RJ, you are writing a book, Productive Harmony Framework. What in the world is that?
Yes, it should be published this late fall, early winter, I think. And as I've gone through my career, and as software developers tend to do, you're working 100-hour weeks back to back over many months. We definitely try and avoid that. But my triathlon history and training, everything in my experience has come back to the idea of energy management. And so if you look at time management, like when you need to get stuff done, when you need to be productive, the first thing people think of is time management. How am I going to manage my time more? And I think that's just not the first thing you could think of. Time management is really an artifact of the 20th century. Today, you really need to think about energy management, sleeping, eating better, moving more. And I'm very cautious to say, because as we were joking about triathlons early on, I was on the podcast about a year ago and mentioned it, and the podcast host had a timer. She was like, I was trying to figure out how long it would be before you mentioned triathlons, because triathletes like talking about doing triathlons. And you don't need to do that. You just move more, makes a difference. And going back to my person with diabetes, there are now glucose meters where for people without diabetes to look at the impact of food and nutrition, exercise. And I know the science, but wearing one of these meters, I was able to see, okay, I eat a particular meal and just sit on the couch afterwards. The next day, I eat the same meal and go for a walk. And my blood glucose responds so much better. And it's all about energy. And so that's the idea of productive harmony. How do we look at productivity today from an energy focus? I'm a morning person. I should be focused much more on things that require creativity focus in the morning. After lunch, I tend to drift and not be as productive. So I spend more time on administrative tasks that don't require a lot of mental energy. And then I typically get a burst of creativity in the afternoon around dinner time. What's fascinating about time management as I was doing research for the book is the gentleman, Frederick Taylor, and he was started, it's called Taylorism, but it was this idea of maximizing productivity in the early 1900s. Bethlehem Steel hired him to increase their productivity. And he was really the person that got this going, this very discrete measurement of activity to understand how to improve productivity. What's fascinating is history's lost and forgotten the fact that he was fired from that job because he showed no improvement in productivity. He was burning out workers. So he was trying to figure out the optimal way to lift a steel beam and move it across the yard. He's okay, how many steps is it? What's the proper body mechanics? He was burning people out by taking that approach. And so today, as so much more work is creative related, we really have to think first about energy management, not time management.
I think that as we become more familiar with this new world of technology, I don't think we'll refer to it as AI anymore, just like we don't refer to electricity and water. It's just there. We just take it for granted and we'll become more accustomed to the benefits of that. And that might allow us to actually stop and look at some of these other, what I'd call life balances that you just got through talking about. But one thing I want to thank you for, RJ, is that you really emphasize the need for a balanced relationship between technology and human expertise, especially in healthcare. And need to move forward. We need to be aggressive, I think, in adopting these AI tools. At the same time, be a little bit cautious. And I think that's the balance that we're trying to bring to the table right now. Any closing thoughts for our audience about the future of AI and in healthcare in particular?
The biggest thing is if you are not using it today, go out and start experimenting with it. And what's fascinating about this technology, more so than many in the past, is as you're trying to learn and figure out how to use it better, just ask it. Just ask it, how can I do better? What do you need when you're talking to ChatGPT? What do you need to be able to do better? As I use these systems to create images nowadays, and those, I don't actually create the prompts myself. I'll go into ChatGPT and describe what I want to do and tell it to ask me questions to produce a better prompt to get a better image. And so it's like this meta level of using ChatGPT to figure out how to use it better. But it's a beautiful thing. It teaches you to use it better and increase your efficiency. So yeah, I joke if you're not impressed, ask it a question and ask it to reply as Bill Gates, and then as Bill Clinton, and then as Bill Murray. And you'll get three completely different responses and different styles, which is just fascinating.
Yeah. Make me a better RJ, right?
Amen.
Richard, great to have you with us on the podcast today. Richard Kedzora, co-founder of Astenda Solutions. Thanks for sharing your insights with our audience today, Richard, RJ.
Thanks for having me. It was a great time.
Thanks for listening today. If you have any questions or want to hear from a specific guest, contact us at gopi.com. That's G-O-P-I, gopi.com. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcasting app to make sure you don't miss any of our episodes.